On our reading from the Bible. These nonconformists, or independents as they were sometimes called, that we're going to be thinking about tonight, were mainly characterized by their opposition to establishment religion. Well, I'd like to think that Jesus shared that with them in some ways. And if you read with me now from Matthew's Gospel, chapter 23, I think you will understand what I mean by that. For in this passage, Jesus is speaking very firmly and strongly about the establishment religion of his own day. Some of the things which he says about the Pharisees here, I'm afraid it has to be said, could be said about establishment religion in almost any period of the world's history. Matthew 23. Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must obey them, and do everything they tell you. But do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. They tie up heavy loads and put them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. Everything they do is done for men to see. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels of their prayer shawls long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted in the marketplaces and have all men call them rabbi. But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have only one master and you are all brothers. And do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one father and he's in heaven. Nor are you to be called teacher, for you have one teacher, the Christ. The greatest among you will be your servant. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You shut the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. You yourselves do not enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as you are. Woe to you, blind guides! You say if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing, but if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he's bound by his oath. You blind fools, which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? You also say if anyone swears by the altar, it means nothing, but if anyone swears by the gift on it, he's bound by his oath. You blind men, which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? Therefore he who swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it, and he who swears by the temple swears by it and by the one who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by God's throne and by the one who sits on it. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, but you have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former, you blind guides! You strain out a gnat, but swallow a camel. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and dish, and then the outside also will be clean. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of dead men's bones and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside you are full of hypocrisy and wickedness. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You build tombs for the prophets and decorate the graves of the righteous. And you say, if we had lived in the days of our forefathers, we would not have taken part with them in the shedding of the blood of the prophets. So you testify against yourselves that you are descendants of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of the sin of your forefathers. You snakes, you brood of vipers, how will you escape being condemned to hell? Therefore I am sending you prophets and wise men and teachers. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Others you will flog in your synagogues and pursue from town to town. As so upon you will come all the righteous blood that has been shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. I tell you the truth, all this will come upon this generation. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, You who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather you, your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. But you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until the day you say, Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. I expect you associate the 5th of November with Guy Fawkes. But the 5th of November is also the anniversary of another occasion, which also, I suppose, is not very auspicious for Roman Catholics. It was on the 5th of November, 1688, 300 years ago this year, that William of Orange, a nobleman related to the British royal family from Holland, who landed at Torbay. James II was then King of England. His army had deserted him, and he knew that his crown was in jeopardy, so he fled. And the English Parliament offered William of Orange his throne. So he became King William III. It was an extraordinary turn of events, completely bloodless as far as England was concerned, though it is worth remembering that William did put down violent resistance to his rule in Ireland, the famous Battle of the Boyne. Nevertheless, it must be regarded as one of the most painless revolutions in world history, and revolution it was. It represented a major watershed in British history, enormously important constitutionally to our parliamentary democracy, and particularly important for our forefathers who were nonconformist Christians. It's the history leading up to that watershed in 1688 that I want to familiarise you with tonight. And to fully understand it, you have to go back not just 300 years, but 1600 years, believe it or not. October the 27th, another near anniversary to the present time, 312 AD. On that date, the Emperor Constantine, the Roman Emperor Constantine, was engaged in battle on a bridge near Rome, Milvian Bridge, with his rival Maxentius. And he's reported to have seen a vision of the cross and received a message from God that he would conquer in the sign of the cross. So he made his soldiers carry it. And he did win. So Constantine became a Christian. Opinions differ as to whether that was a triumph for the church or a catastrophe. For you see, up until that moment in time, the Christian church had been a minority sect, often persecuted by the authorities. But from the conversion of the emperor, Christianity became the establishment religion of the Roman Empire. Bishops became politicians, and politicians became bishops. The state and the church were no longer rivals, but allies. In fact, a new era in church history had dawned. The period of the early church had ended. And with the conversion of Constantine, you could say the medieval period really begins. The medieval period in which the Church of Rome, at least in the Western countries of Europe, dominated the political scene for all of 1,200 years. Sometimes popes wielded more authority than all the princes and kings of Europe put together during that period. And so it remained, as I say, for over a millennium. Till another date, just around about now. November the 1st, this time. 1517. That was the date when a young monk trained in law at the University of Wittenberg nailed 95 theses to the church door there. They were theses about a rather abstruse subject, actually. Martin Luther objected to the sale of indulgences by the Roman Catholic Church. At that time, the Pope was trying to build St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, and it needed a lot of money. So to help him raise it, he was selling indulgences around the Catholic countries of Europe. An indulgence was a kind of offer of freedom from purgatory for somebody. And the church was teaching these could actually be purchased with money contributed to the building of St. Peter's. Martin Luther didn't think that was right for a whole range of reasons, 95 reasons in all, and he told the Pope all of them. Some of them were, frankly, nationalistic. If the Pope wants to build St. Peter's, he says, let him take his money off poor Italian peasants, not poor German ones. But some of them were also theological. He began to question the Pope's supremacy over the church in Germany, or indeed the Pope's supremacy over any church. Shouldn't we get our doctrine, he says, not from popes and councils, but from the Bible, from the scriptures? Now, he wasn't the first person to say that. Other brave souls had said it before. But when he said it, the tinder was dry, and his 95 theses were the spark that set it on fire. Before long, Reformation was burning all over Europe. Huge changes took place in a very short space of time. All sorts of centuries-old doctrines of the Catholic Church were revised or called into question by reformers who applied themselves to the study of the Bible and wanted to see if these things were really true from the apostolic documents they found there. However, there is one interesting thing. Neither Luther nor the other reformers that followed him seriously questioned establishment religion. None of them seriously suggested that the church and the state shouldn't be organized together, shouldn't be part of the same power complex. It's true that Martin Luther believed in two kingdoms. He believed that the secular state should be governed by Old Testament law and the Church of Jesus should be governed by New Testament gospel. And there was, at least in principle, there a division of church and state. But in practice, he relied very heavily on the German princes for the establishment of his Reformation. Whatever he said about the two kingdoms, he tended to act as if he only believed there was one. And this was even more true of John Calvin, a great reformer, a man of more penetrating intellect, perhaps, than any of his generation. He was the reformer who worked in Geneva. And though in many ways the Reformation at Geneva purged the church of more of its Catholic traditions, more of its medieval traditions, than anywhere else in Europe, Calvin nevertheless didn't reject establishment religion. If anything, he was more committed to the medieval theocratic ideal of a church state than Luther was. He saw Geneva as the kingdom of God in miniature, and every person who lived in Geneva as a member of that church. And the political magistrates and the church elders were both involved in administering the city. Well, it was into this welter of controversy and discussion about the nature of the church that Queen Elizabeth I stepped in 1558, when she came to the throne of England. The years leading up to her reign had been very troublesome. Her father, Henry VIII, had broken with the Pope and made concessions to the Reformation, but generally for reasons of political expediency to do with his wives, more than any deep theological conviction about the rightness of the Reformation doctrine. Her brother, Edward VI, had encouraged the Reformation from a sincere heart and had established a new prayer book and had elevated Protestant clergy like Cranmer and Ridley. But then Elizabeth's sister had come to the throne, Mary, the daughter of a Spanish princess. She was a fanatical Catholic and had mercilessly executed hundreds of Protestants, including Cranmer and Ridley. Always round, then, it was a rather confusing scene. When Elizabeth came to the throne, what she wanted more than anything else was a settlement, a quiet life, you could say. For herself, she didn't like the papal domination of Europe, especially she didn't like the papal domination of England. She was very much a nationalist. And especially she didn't like the imperialist ambitions of Catholic Spain, which were a great threat around that time. You remember the Spanish Armada and all that. But the austerities of Calvin's Geneva were too extreme for her taste as well, and she particularly disliked John Knox, the reformer of Scotland, who had made some very discreditable remarks about women in politics. So Queen Elizabeth decided there would have to be a compromise. England would be a Protestant country, all right, but it would be different from the Protestants of the continent. We would have a Church of England. We in England could always do things better than they over there. And it would take a mediating line. It would have sermons, and it would use Cranmer's wonderful prayer book, but there would also be vestments and an altar. Most especially, it would be an established church, with her, the Queen of England, as its head, just as her father Henry VIII had said, defender of the faith and head of the church. So she passed an act of supremacy enforcing that. She was the head of the Church of England. And she then passed an act of uniformity, which said everybody else had better be a member of the Church of England or else. And that's how the Puritans began. See, the Puritans didn't like the Elizabethan settlement. It didn't go far enough. The majority of them were much more enamoured of Calvin's Geneva. They were Calvinists, and they believed that they wanted the church in England to go in that direction. They wanted a more thoroughgoing reform of the church. The Elizabethan settlement wasn't enough. They were divided, though, into two camps. There was the Presbyterian camp, who wanted a Presbyterian Church of England, much like Calvin's Geneva. Even in Elizabeth's day, though, it was also possible to identify a much smaller group who were Congregationalists and were in favour of a disestablished church altogether. They didn't want a Church of England, Presbyterian or Episcopal. They wanted independent local churches. One of the most interesting figures attached to those independents or congregationalists was Robert Brown, actually educated at Corpus Christi. He was very clear that he didn't like the Anglican scheme that the Elizabethan settlement had proposed, but he wanted the churches in England to be independent, democratic, self-governing congregations. When he looked in the Bible, he said he couldn't find the church as a kind of institution. He could only find churches, local churches. Now, by and large, Elizabeth tolerated the Presbyterian party, but the Congregationalists were regarded with great suspicion. To suggest this separation of church and state was widely regarded as seditious, treasonable. And so a number of those early Congregationalists, men like Henry Barrow and John Greenwood and John Penry, died. They were hanged. So began the troubles of the independent Puritan wing. But they were only part of a much bigger problem that was on the horizon. You see, within the church in general in England, we now had two major groups. There was a pro-Catholic party, generally speaking, supported by the monarchy. And there was a Puritan party, generally speaking, supported by Parliament. And that, as I say, spelled trouble for the future. In 1603... King James I came to the throne, the first of the Stuart house. And many of the Puritans hoped that with his accession, there would be concessions made to their Puritan ideas for the Church of England. But they were unfortunately disappointed. At a big conference in Hampton Court, just after James I was crowned, he dismissed the Puritans and all their suggestions and made it quite clear they weren't going to get any concessions from him. On the contrary, if anything, the Church of England was going to go in the Catholic direction. The whole Stuart dynasty was inclined in that direction. So the Puritans began to become disheartened. Some of them gave up on England altogether and decided the only way forward was to go to America, the famous Pilgrim Fathers. One of their leaders, John Robinson, was actually an independent, a Congregationalist. though the majority of them were Presbyterians. Another interesting thing, though, that began to happen at this time was the emergence within the Independent Party of another group. Some of the Congregationalists went a little bit further than being mere Congregationalists, took the logic of independency in the church a little further and said they were going to be Baptists. You see, they realized that the real quarrel between the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians was over who was properly considered a member of the church. The Presbyterians and the Anglicans, come to that, both wanted to say that you could be born a Christian. The Anglicans tended to say you were born a Christian by virtue of the place you were born. You were born in England, right. You're a Christian. You're born in a parish. The Presbyterians were more subtle than that. They tended to say, if you're born to Christian parents, then you're within the covenant community of the church. But you're still born a Christian, fundamentally. There's a presumption that if you're born in a Christian country or born in a Christian family, then you're a Christian and should be treated as such. And that's why they practiced infant baptism. If you're born a Christian, why shouldn't you be baptized as a child? But the Baptists realized that their quarrel was really with that whole thought. They didn't believe that you could draw a circle around an area on the map and say everybody born in that area is a Christian. Nor did they believe that you could draw a circle around certain families and say they are Christian families and any baby born in that group of families is a Christian. They insisted you could only become a Christian through personal decision, personal faith. It wasn't a question of you being born a Christian and then opting out. You had to decide to become a Christian and then opt in. So the church was not an amorphous gathering of all the people who lived or were born within a certain radius or within certain circumstances. The church was a gathered group of people who had voluntarily come together because they knew they had something in common, faith in Jesus. That's what the Congregationalists said. The Baptists simply went one step further. Why then do we baptize in infancy? If we don't believe that you can be born a Christian, then we don't believe you should be baptized as a baby. You should be baptized when you become a Christian, when you opt in, when you become a member of the church. So we find Congregationalists and Baptists mingling together, often congregations which were originally Congregationalists moving over to become Baptists, and vice versa. There was quite a lot of intermingling, but nevertheless, two distinct points of view on this question of baptism emerging around this time. Well, so the Puritans then knew things weren't going very well for them. They had a lot of opposition from the state. And when Charles I came to the throne, things got even worse. Charles I was an even more committed Catholic, more committed to the Stuart Catholic way than James had been. And he took even more steps to further the drift towards Catholicism. This was the time when the Archbishop of Canterbury was a very strong Anglo-Catholic, and there was a great deal of trouble and persecution for the Puritans. There was another general migration to New England. Thousands and thousands went to New England around this time. And, of course, the tension between the monarchy and Parliament began to get more and more acute. For the monarchy, as we've said, was in favour of the drift towards Catholicism. But the Parliament was made up chiefly of Puritans and independents, a lot of independents and Presbyterians, so that they were passing acts of Parliament which the King was refusing to endorse. And the King was dissolving Parliament so it couldn't pass any laws, and all sorts of nonsenses were going on. Well, in the end, of course, the whole thing blew up in civil war. Most of us are familiar, I suppose, from our school days with this period of English history when the parliamentarians rebelled in violent revolution against the supporters, the royalists, the supporters of the crown. And it was at that time, of course, that Oliver Cromwell came to the fore with his brilliant military strategy. Now, Oliver Cromwell was an independent. He was a Congregationalist. He belonged to that group of Puritans, and so did most of his army. So even though Parliament at that time was probably predominantly Presbyterian, he had a big say. I mean, he had the bigger stick. And it has to be said that Oliver Cromwell used his victories, his very magnificent victories, to squeeze the Presbyterians, to push their point of view a bit out. In a sense, I have to say I have some sympathy with Cromwell in this. Because, you see, Cromwell was a much more tolerant spirit than the Presbyterians. The Presbyterians really wanted, as we said before, a Presbyterian Church of England. And they weren't satisfied with anything less than that. But Cromwell, being an independent, wasn't interested in the Church of England at all. All he wanted was freedom, Christian liberty, for any Christian man or woman to worship God according to their own conscience. He was against Catholicism. He didn't want to give toleration to Catholics. He was pretty hard on the Irish for that reason. But within the period of his day, he was an extraordinarily broad-minded man, a very broad-minded Protestant. Provided somebody was a believer in Jesus Christ and committed to the Bible, he didn't mind really how they worshipped, what order they used. They could be Congregationalists, they could be Baptists, they could be Presbyterians. He was even prepared for them to be Quakers, things like that. In fact, I suppose partly because of the tolerance of the man, there was an enormous amount of sectarianism within his army and supporters. All kinds of crazy ideas began to get pushed around. Strange apocalyptic ideas, eschatological ideas about the end of the world being right at hand, and how Oliver Cromwell was the beginnings of a great new kingdom of God on earth, and things like that were beginning to get thought about. And that sort of fanaticism caused a lot of suspicion and doubt, particularly amongst those Presbyterians who didn't really feel Cromwell was fully on their side anyway. All this meant that at the end of the Civil War, and at the end of Cromwell's period in office, there was a vacuum left. Partly because of the sectarianism and division in Cromwell's own party, partly because of the incompetence of his son and heir, and partly, perhaps mainly, because the Presbyterians were not really satisfied that Cromwell's party were going to do what they wanted and produce a Presbyterian church in England. There was pressure, believe it or not, to bring back the king. And the Presbyterians agreed to that and indeed encouraged that. I think in saying that, in doing that, they showed themselves hopelessly outmaneuvered and naive. It certainly wasn't for lack of able minds to explain to them the virtues of independency. People like John Milton and John Owen were writing at this time. It certainly wasn't for the lack of brave men to stand up at the Westminster Assembly, which was, of course, mainly Presbyterian, and explain the independent position and dissent from the Westminster Confession at certain key points because of it. But I think there was a political naivety, and the Presbyterians, particularly in Scotland, were completely outmaneuvered by Charles II's party. They really believed that when Charles II came back, he was going to institute Presbyterianism in Scotland, like the Solemn Oath and Covenant, which they had taken so. But when he actually came back, he did the opposite. Stuart, he was still pro-Catholic, and instead of bringing about the Puritan changes that they had all wanted, there was further and even more draconian measures to establish Catholicism in the Church of England. A number of acts were passed, which are often called the Clarendon Code. The Corporation Act, for instance, made it impossible for anybody to occupy public office who wasn't an Anglican. The Act of Uniformity, another act like the Act of Uniformity which Elizabeth had passed, enforced the prayer book. And as a result of that, 2,000 ministers, church ministers, were expelled from their office in this country. Then there was the Conventicle Act, which said that not more than 5 people could meet together in order to prevent dissenters from gathering for worship. And then there was the 5 Mile Act, which said that nobody who'd ever been a dissenting minister could live within 5 miles of the place where he used to be a minister. And then there was the Test Act, which said that all civil and military and educational opportunity in the country was forbidden to anybody who wasn't an Anglican. The upshot of it was that the Puritans, and particularly the Congregationalists, were kept out of everything except the business world. And that may be why in the centuries that followed you often find people from Puritan backgrounds quite significant in the development of the Industrial Revolution. I don't know. Scotland paid a particularly heavy price for her collaboration with Charles II. The Covenanters, as they were called, were brutally put down. And in England, this is the time when John Bunyan, who we spoke about earlier, was put in prison. Put in prison because he wasn't an Anglican. He wouldn't conform to Charles II's code. Well, things didn't get better when James II came to the throne. Things didn't get better when James II came to the throne. There was increasingly open opposition to this Catholic tendency among the Stuarts. There was a revolution down in Cornwall, which was again brutally put down by the notorious Judge Jeffreys. Even dear Richard Baxter, who'd never hurt a fly, was put in prison by Judge Jeffreys on some pretext. It couldn't go on. The English people were getting more and more fed up with the Stuarts and their wares. And so it was that on that 5th of November, 1688, when James II had only been on the throne 2 or 3 years, William III landed at the invitation of a group of peers of the realm and parliamentarians. He landed at Torbay, and already the revolution had been set, the negotiations had gone on behind the scenes. It was a set-up job, really. He knew the throne would be his for the taking with the minimum of force. And so it was. And with his coming ended this vexed period of time, over 100 years, in which Puritans, may they be Presbyterians or Free Churchmen, Independents, had struggled with this Catholicizing tendency within the Church of England to gain for themselves a measure of liberty of worship. In a matter of just 1 or 2 years, William passed first a Bill of Rights, which was very important constitutionally. It ensured free speech and free elections in England. And he passed the Toleration Act, which gave freedom of religion to nonconformists, the first time they had really been granted that. And he gave the Scottish Church, after all its struggles, the Presbyterianism it had always wanted. It's important not to overstate what William III did. There was still no freedom of religion for Catholic or Jews. And he didn't repeal the Test and Corporation Acts. That's why nonconformists were still kept out of universities like Oxford and Cambridge and still couldn't become MPs or even high-ranking soldiers until right up into the 19th century. But it was a watershed. For the first time, these independents, these Congregationalists, were able to worship in churches without having to belong to the Church of England. And here in Cambridge, we have a little bit of the history of that. You see this man, Francis Holcroft. He was the minister of the church in Bassingbourne, near here, a Puritan. And when the Clarendon Comb was passed by Charles II, he was ejected with all those other 2,000 ministers from his living, and indeed from his... he was also a fellow of one of the colleges in Cambridge, and he lost that fellowship too. And what he did was to begin to meet with some of the members of his congregation in the woods near Great Eversden. Many of these ejected ministers did that. They couldn't meet in the city, they couldn't meet in any public building, so they met in secret, often under oak trees, many of which are still standing and sort of have this history attached to them. Well, he met under an oak tree in the woods near Great Eversden, around the back of Wimpole there. And out of that small group of believing men and women that gathered around him there, he appointed 4 assistants. And one of those assistants he sent to Cambridge. And they founded a little independent Congregationalist church in Cambridge. At that time, of course, it was illegal. And they met in a house in Green Street. But even though it was illegal, and even though they, of course, suffered for their dissenting views. They kept on meeting. And in 1689, when the Act of Toleration was passed, they were at last able to become a legal church and build their own chapel, and that they did, in Green Street, where they had been meeting. It was, 150 years later, in the early part of the 19th century, that that congregation, after a checkered history, which we can't possibly go into tonight, decided it would like to move. So they built a new chapel in Fitzroy Street, just down the road here. And that chapel got too small, wasn't very comfortable. They knocked it down, built another one on the same site, again in Fitzroy Street. Till in 1983, Grosvenor Estates decided they wanted that particular building to make part of a big new shopping mall. And the Independents, who by this time had become Baptists, as well as Congregationalists, became resident in a new place of worship on the corner of Fair Street, called Eden Chapel. What are the lessons, then, we ought to learn from this long and tortuous period of history? Let me just suggest to you three lessons that I think it's worth trying to think about and keep hold of. The first lesson, I think, that comes out of this whole period of history is the folly of disunity among Bible-believing Christians. See, the Puritan Party was really very, very strong and had a great many intellectuals in its midst. If only they had retained their unity, they might have succeeded. But instead, they fell into all kinds of divisions, not over the fundamentals of Christianity. If you look at the Westminster Confession and compare it to the Savoy Declaration, the Congregationalist Statement of Faith, and then compare it to the 1689 Statement of Baptist Faith, they're all the same. They all teach the same doctrine. The only area where they differed was on this question of church government. And yet that issue was enough to make them suspicious of one another. It was enough to make the Presbyterians take the side of the Stuart monarchy against Cromwell's party and invite the Stuarts back into control of the country at that critical time around 1660. I say the folly of disunity among evangelical Christians, something we can learn, I think, from that. The second thing I think we have to learn from this whole period is there are times when Christians must expect to suffer for conscience' sake. This kind of toleration, which we take for granted now, the freedom to meet in a place like this and have any kind of church service we want and say whatever we want, study the Bible together without any kind of authority above us which says, if you don't come to these conclusions about this and this and this and this, you know, you're going to be put in prison or fined or not be allowed to stay at Cambridge University. That sort of toleration we take for granted, but it is in fact rare. It's rare in history. It's rare in the world even today. That kind of toleration is something which is comparatively recent and still comparatively rare. The majority of Christians in this world have to expect discrimination, even active persecution, for conscience' sake. Many of our forefathers had to be sufficiently committed to their understanding of the Bible to be willing to pay a very big price for it. That's a challenge to us, isn't it? As to whether we are as committed to it as that. But the third thing I have to say, we haven't got time to develop it at length tonight, but the third thing I have to say is that I do believe we should learn from this period of history to beware of establishment religion. Now, I don't wish to be thought to be getting at Anglicans or Presbyterians. I have many Anglican and Presbyterian friends, admire them and value them enormously. But on this point, I am an independent myself, and I don't think the issue is so trivial that we ought not sometimes to be made to think about it. The Anglicans and Presbyterians take this view that you can be born a Christian, or at least born in such a way as you should be presumed you are a Christian. I don't believe that's true. Anglicans and Presbyterians take the view that it is conceivable, even desirable, that there should be a national church, an established church, bound in with the politics of the realm. I don't believe that's true. I believe the evidence of the Bible is against it. Paul didn't go around setting up the church. He went about founding churches. Independent, local churches. But more than the biblical evidence, I think the testimony of history is against it. Establishment Christianity does several things. First, it dilutes the church. It always means that the church has a large number of uncommitted, even unregenerate members in it. Establishment religion always encourages nominal religion. That's never healthy for the Church of Jesus Christ. Secondly, establishment religion almost invariably compromises the church, because it means the church has a vested interest in the status quo. It's perfectly true, of course, that the Church of England is no longer the Tory party at prayer. But it was for a very long while. And I think, you know, it's significant that it has only been able to break free of that image as the Tory party of prayer as its political significance in the country has declined. Almost invariably, establishment religion compromises the church with all kinds of vested interests which don't really put the kingdom of God at the center of things. Thirdly, I think establishment religion saps the missionary flexibility of the church, because an establishment church is always a church which is heavily traditional and culture-bound. It has to be. It is a vehicle of national culture. But that means it is often very slow to adapt to cultural change, or indeed to adapt to the missionary challenge of new cultures which come in. Non-established churches, free churches, independent churches historically have always had much greater flexibility to adapt themselves to the needs of the hour, quickly, radically. You see that happening even today in the charismatic house churches. In fact, again and again, it is notable that revival has had to begin outside of the established church. It's never been able to begin within it, because the structures weren't flexible enough to contain it. And the third thing I have to say, if I'm honest, is this, that establishment religion can always become a persecuting religion. Congregationalism and independency never can. It has no political arm. But once you join church and state together, it is always possible, and the course of history has shown that it happens, it is always possible that the power of the state may be used against dissent. So, Cranmer was burned at Oxford. Why? Because he wasn't a Catholic. So, Bunyan was imprisoned in Bedford. Why? Because he wasn't an Anglican. So, Menno Simons and his followers were persecuted in Europe. Why? Because they weren't Calvinist Genevans. Established churches, establishment religion, always has this potential. I don't say it will happen. I don't see the Church of England wanting to persecute me. But it's a danger. And it's one of the lessons of history that is worth learning. It was, remember, the religious establishment that crucified the master.